Welcome to Break the Chains, America's top radio source of information for people struggling with drug or alcohol addiction and those who love them. And now, the host of Break the Chains, Gwen Cardin.
Like millions of mothers before her, Sandy Swenson gazed with wonder into the eyes of her newborn son, Joey. As he gazed back, she tried to imagine the bright, exciting future that her little boy would have. Would he be a doctor, a lawyer, a teacher? How many grandchildren would his future wife give to her? How many ways would this wonderful bundle of joy make a difference in the world? Sandy imagined so much about her little boy, but the one thing she never imagined was that he would grow up to be a drug addict. He would become someone who, despite all the love that she and his father could give him, would wreak havoc on his life and on hers until she discovered that she had the power to find her own recovery, even if Joey didn't. For many years, Sandy clung to her dreams, believing if she just loved Joey a little bit more, or stood by his side one more time as he twisted in the wind of his lies, misdeeds, and crimes. If she gave him one more chance, then one more, and well, maybe just one more chance, somehow everything would be okay. But when it wasn't, and Sandy finally realized that she could do nothing more to save Joey, she let go and she moved on with her life, and then she wrote about it, all of it, in her forthcoming heart-wrenching book, The Joey Song, A Mother's Story of Her Son's Addiction. Sandy's here today to tell that story. Welcome to the show, Sandy.
Hi, Gwen. Thank you so much for having me here.
Well, it's a delight. I want to start by asking you this question. What prompted you to write the book?
Well, I started with at the suggestion of a friend to write a journal, which turned out to be the best thing I did because instead of roaming the house every night, trying to piece together the lies, save them to piece together with the next lie, I could put everything down on paper and set it aside and not have to carry it with me all day, every day. Then as time went on, it occurred to me that I wanted to write the book that I wished I could have found when I started out on this journey, and the book that I wished that everybody who loved Joey and loved me could also read as we went through this journey. I wanted to write the book that was brutally honest, yet inspiring, a book that would help others to feel understood and less alone.
Well, it certainly does that. It's very hard to put it down, and your writing is beautiful. I know you were not a professional writer until now, but you certainly joined those ranks. Just briefly, where is Joey today, and how old is he?
Joey is currently in Florida. He's been in Florida since 2008 when he left his last addiction treatment there. He is 26, soon to be 27.
Now, your book is titled The Joey Song. Where did that title come from?
The Joey Song is something that I used to sing to Joey when he was little, and it has very poignant meaning. I wonder if I could read an excerpt from the book that brings us to the point which explains how I came to titling the book The Joey Song.
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to hear it.
Okay. Today, Joey returns to the place where his life began, but he's returning on a stretcher. Cruising down the coastal highway in a four-door sedan at 50 miles per hour, Joey slammed into an SUV, a line of mailboxes, and a stone wall. No brake marks before bouncing into oncoming traffic. He arrived here in an ambulance, bloodied and unresponsive, with enough alcohol in his bloodstream to kill him, if his internal injuries don't kill him first. 20 years, 5 months, and 6 days ago, Joey tumbled into my world at this very hospital. We greeted each other, this baby and me, but we already knew each other. We already knew life's most quiet love. He nestled in where he belonged, close to the heart he's had for 9 months, and into the arms whose most important purpose was now to protect, care for, and love. I can't hold Joey this time. He's too wrecked all over, too battered, bruised, and scraped. I'm afraid of hurting him, but my longing to touch Joey is greater than my fear. I find a small spot on his blood-crusted forehead where it seems safe to place a soft kiss. I hold on to his cold, limp hand. He is so pale, so gray, so still. The only sound is the dirge of whirs and beeps and gurgles, the sucking and trickling of life's juices through a tangle of tubes and mechanical attachments. And the whimpering. I think the whimpering is me. Joey fills the entire bed. The 6-foot length of his body sags down the elevated slope. His legs all crumpled in akimbo at the bottom. His hospital gown reveals he has more bone than meat. Joey's hands and feet, like a puppy's paws, don't fit the rest of him. But Joey's not as thin as the last time I saw him, several months ago, back when I told him it hurt more for me to hang on than to let go, back when I told him I was done trying to help him until he was ready. This is not what I thought ready would look like. Joey does not move, not the tiniest bit other than the mechanical expansion of his chest. He doesn't know I'm here, but still, I talk. I want to reach the part of him imprisoned for so many years. Maybe I can slip past the wily warden of addiction and touch Joey while he's unconscious. I tell Joey I love him bigger than the moon, that I flew here as quickly as I could, and that his dad's plane will land soon. Joey, you were in a car accident. No one else was injured. And then I lie. Things will be better now. I cannot breathe. I pray for more time. Sitting at his side, I pat Joey's stiff and bloodied hair. Golden locks I've washed 1,000 times between bubbles and boats. I no longer see the addict my son has become, a person I no longer know at all. Instead, I see my little boy, snug as in his innocence, transposed over this wounded, lifeless man face. I see the glow of his smooth cheeks peeping out from under rumpled covers as I stand over his small bed late at night. A sob escapes me as I remember the little boy with a sticky giggle who one long ago day asked me to sing him his special song. Mommy, will you sing me the Joey song? The Joey song? As Joey wriggled onto my lap, his blue eyes searched my face, and I silently willed the song to come to mind. Oh, the Joy song. My heart warmed. For countless renditions, Joey had heard my crooning as a love song about him. And so I held my little fellow tight and sang the song that had tender new meaning, the song that was so much more wonderful sung his way. I've got that Joey down in my heart. Down in my heart, down in my heart. I've got that Joey, down in my heart, down in my heart to stay. That's enough the old song now. I lean close to Joey's ear and sing. A damp and croaky whisper, I sing the Joey song, hoping to reach something deep within this lost child of mine, hoping to stir up memories of love, real love, a love so much better than the love he has for the things that feed his addiction. I want to take Joey back to a time before all the pain. I sing softly. I don't want the addict to hear. I ache for Joey to believe what can't be seen. These recent years have been a test of the strength of my heart, but the strength of my love has never wavered, not even under pressure of the mind-bending contortion imposed by his addiction. Joey, can you hear me? It's love that kept me from helping you to hurt yourself any longer. It is love that kept vigil while I waited for you to hit a bottom that wasn't dead. It is love that brought me to here and now. Joey doesn't know I am here. He doesn't move. Never could I have imagined an illness so cruel. With its insidious ways, a nasty grin, addiction not only snuffed out my child's emerging light, it broke bonds and hurts and all the rules. Addiction is the destroyer of everything.
That gives me goosebumps. And that is just a small sampling of the passion and the poignancy with which you have written every single book and every single page in your book. Tell us a little bit about Joey as a little boy.
He was my firstborn son. Blonde-haired, blue-eyed, very smart, handsome. Everybody loved him. Scholarships to college, Eagle Scout, just a really wonderful child.
Well, what was the first sign that he was using drugs?
Well, there were probably many, many signs that he was using drugs that we did not see. The first sign that he was using drugs that we recognized didn't come really until he was already an addict. When he first started displaying troubled behaviors, we thought they were just teenage behaviors. And then when he was becoming dangerously thin and volatile and moody, we were living in India at the time, and we attributed the weight loss to having lived in India. Eventually, I took him back to the United States for several months for a treatment for an eating disorder, which turns out wasn't exactly an eating disorder. It was later we discovered that he was actually already an addict at that time and had tried to stop using drugs, and it had just sort of transferred over temporarily to an eating disorder. And then he was back to addiction. But he fooled not only us, but also the doctors. So,
And he was how old when this occurred?
He was 16.
And how long do you think he had been in addiction?
Oh, I think that he had probably been an addict for about a year. They say that you don't see the signs of addiction until the late stages. And they also say that some people become addicts faster than others. So I believe that my son is one of those. He became an addict very quickly. I know from what he told us later that he had smoked pot when he was in junior high and that he had drank alcohol when he was in junior high. I suspect that when he became a junior in high school was when he became an addict.
Is this while you were in India?
We were in India when he was a junior and a senior in high school.
So he got much more involved in drugs once he was in India. Were they more readily available there?
Well, yes, they were very readily available. They had little tuk-tuks that would drive around, apparently, and the kids knew which ones they could just get drugs from. But I was completely unaware of that the whole entire time that we lived in India. I had no idea that Joey was doing drugs. I knew he was drinking some. I had no idea he was doing drugs. He was an Eagle Scout. He was working in orphanages. He was getting scholarships for college. This just didn't fit with the boy that could possibly be doing drugs. It never even crossed my mind.
Mm-hmm. So it was a big shock when you found out when he went for the eating disorder. Is that when you realized he was doing drugs, or did that come after he had the eating disorder treatment?
No, that came long after the eating disorder treatment. Then he came back to India. I stayed with him for 4 months over in the U.S. and then returned to India. He graduated from high school. We moved back to the United States as a family, and we thought the eating disorder was behind us. And he went off to college, and that's when things started to really crumble apart. That's
okay.
When he was arrested on his way driving to college because he was speeding and he had some drugs in the car. And then right after college started, he had a suicide attempt. And then we all decided that it's best if he didn't go to college. And then he came back and lived with us for a while. And then we had him right there under our roof and witnessed his downward spiral. But he didn't live with us for long.
Well, listen, it's time to take a short break, but stay tuned, and we'll be right back with more interesting conversation with author Sandy Swenson.
an adult suffering from drug or alcohol addiction, why not make today the day that you break the chains? At New Life Addiction Treatment Center in Port St. Lucie, Florida, we know it's not easy to pick up the phone and make that call. But remember, the caring staff at New Life is here to help. Count on us to partner with you to guide you towards getting your life back. Our confidential residential program takes most insurance plans and is designed to help meet your unique needs. Write this number down and give New Life Addiction Treatment Center a call right now. The toll-free number is 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. Your life is waiting for you, and so are we. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or getsobernow.net.
Is there someone you love who is suffering from alcohol or drug addiction? Do you feel like you simply don't know where to turn? We at Addiction Recovery Helpline know how painful it can be for both your loved one and for you and your family. We also realize that it's never easy to send someone you care about into rehab, but it's easier when you partner with us. Let Addiction Recovery Helpline assist your adult loved one to break the chains of addiction by finding just the right treatment center to meet their needs. Call us today toll-free at 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. It's too important to wait even one more day to make that call. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or on the web at getsobernow.net. Most insurance plans accepted.
And now, back to Gwen Cardin on Break the Chains.
Today we're talking with author Sandy Swenson, who's written a heart-wrenching book about her journey as the mother of a drug-addicted son. Sandy, before the break, you talked about the family moving back from India, and very quickly thereafter you said that Joey moved out. What did he start doing with his life? How did it start unraveling?
When he came back to live with us, it was with the intention of him returning to college, and he needed to do some things to get his life in order before he did so. And suddenly he didn't like house rules, and he didn't like any rules at all, actually. So he stopped seeing the doctor, and he stopped doing absolutely everything that we had requested of him, and he decided he would just rather move out than follow rules. So he did that. He got an apartment. He started working at a restaurant, which is pretty much what he's done ever since, is just working at restaurants or bars. And his life just started to crumble. And we still at that point, even though he had tried to commit suicide and even though he had tried or been arrested on his way out to college, we had no idea he was an addict. We just thought we had a kid who's in trouble. And we were trying to sort it out from afar. And he didn't live that far. He lived, you know, in the next town over. But his behavior changed dramatically to become very volatile and mean. And his appearance changed to mohawk and piercings and tattoos, and which was all very different for him. And a boy who used to be very close to his family was now impossible to get hold of, and he missed holidays, and months would pass without us seeing him. He was arrested numerous times, overdoses, most of which I knew about because I was a, not proud of it, but did it anyway, was that I was a Facebook stalker. I knew his password, and I followed everything he did online, and so I knew when he was arrested, and I knew when he was overdosing, so then I would try to track him down and find out what was happening and try to steer him to help, and he didn't want any of that. So it was always when a big crisis, when he was actually arrested or had to go to court or something like that, when we were able to even try to do anything. You know, we worked with the judge very closely, trying to get him into addiction treatment as opposed to into jail.
Do you know what drugs he was taking at that point?
We knew he was smoking pot. Pot was definitely where everything started and ends with him, because even after rehab, many rehabs, he always continued to say that he will never quit smoking pot. He might quit everything else, but never quit smoking pot. So it started with pot and drinking, but then it progressed, and cocaine was very big for him then, and mushrooms were very big for him then, and he was abusing, I believe it was Benadryl, and those are kind of the things he was using at that time. Since then, he's progressed to using absolutely everything, but at the time, that's what he was using.
Mm-hmm. And what was this doing to your family? Now, you have a younger son as well, so that had to have had some pretty serious impact on the whole family's life.
Oh, it did, because honestly, during that whole time, for years, from 2005 until from 2004 to 2008, I would say that even though I was always there as an at-home mom, I wasn't there for my younger son, Rick. I was completely and totally consumed with trying to figure out what was happening with Joey and trying to fix what was happening with Joey. So Ricky, you know, when I went to the eating disorder in India, I left him for 4 months. And when we moved to a new house, I left him on his first day of school in a new city to go save Joey from having tried to commit suicide. And on Ricky's 16th birthday, I was somewhere at a rehab at a family program. And when Ricky graduated from high school, his brother was down the street in jail. And it was constant. It was constant. Me in particular, just consumed with Joey and his issues. We would talk to Rick about all of Joey's issues. We were very open and honest, so he knew what was happening. We explained to him that we love both of our children equally, but right now Joey actively needs a different sort of love, and that his time would come too. But it could not have been easy for Rick. It could not have been easy, but he's graduated from college. He's never had one issue with drugs or alcohol or the law or any, really. And he's turned into a fine young man, and only he can take the credit because his dad and I made a lot of mistakes with him because of our attention to Joey's addiction.
Do you feel that you were enabling Joey? Because I know you state in your book, you talk about your own recovery. What exactly were you recovering from?
Well, I'm recovering from my son's addiction. I'm recovering my own recovery in letting go of the addiction that was destroying me and my family. I had taken it on as though I could fix it. It wasn't until I realized that this is not my problem to fix. Only Joey can do what he needs to do to survive. And only I can do my part of doing what I, as a mother who loves an addicted child, needs to do to survive. And I also knew that as a mother, if I didn't do what I needed, my whole family was going to be destroyed by addiction. So I definitely enabled my son. We all enable our children. And I think those of us who love an addict enable our children to the extreme, because it goes, every maternal instinct is telling us to help our children. And that line between helping and hurting becomes very fuzzy and very confusing. And it takes a long time to figure out the difference between the two.
Is there anything that you look back on that you think was maybe the biggest mistake of all in terms of your role in this situation?
Oh, my goodness. We've made so many mistakes. It would be hard to say which was the biggest mistake of them all.
Well, let me ask you this. Is it something that you carry around guilt about, or are you able to forgive yourself, or are you able to understand that it happened that the way it did because you were doing the best that you could?
Oh, I don't feel any guilt. Mm. And I think that's one of the reasons that I wrote my book, and I think that's one of the reasons that my book might speak to other mothers like me, is that I don't feel any guilt because I understand that addiction is a disease. There's nothing that I could do to cause my son's addiction. Now, I did plenty of things wrong, but every parent does things wrong. And if imperfect parenting is the cause of addiction, everybody would be an addict.
Right, right. And I was asking that question not because I feel like you did anything outside the norm, but I know other people are doing some of the things that you did, and they're probably feeling guilt and shame about it. And I thought it would be important to explain why that is unproductive and really not even the way it should be.
Right, right. Because it is. It's absolutely unproductive. As long as, if we can come to understand addiction as a disease, we know that we can't cause somebody else to have a disease. We also know that we can't cause that person to get over the disease. We can support them as they do their own work, no matter what that disease might be. We can't force anybody to take their medication or do their therapy or whatever the regime is that they must do. We can support them and encourage them and be their biggest cheerleader, but we cannot fix it for them, and we did not cause it to happen either. I think a lot of people get confused with the notion that addiction is not just a matter of using. It's when using goes from dalliance into disease, and that is a distinction that not any person can cause.
Interesting. Well, I'll tell you what, we need to take another break right now, and we'll continue talking to Sandy Swenson about her life as the mother of a drug-addicted son in just a couple of minutes, so don't go away.
Is there someone you love who is suffering from alcohol or drug addiction? Do you feel like you simply don't know where to turn? We at Addiction Recovery Helpline know how painful it can be for both your loved one and for you and your family. We also realize that it's never easy to send someone you care about into rehab, but it's easier when you partner with us. Let Addiction Recovery Helpline assist your adult loved one to break the chains of addiction by finding just the right treatment center to meet their needs. Call us today toll-free at 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. It's too important to wait even one more day to make that call. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or on the web at getsobernow.net. Most insurance plans accepted.
If you're an adult suffering from drug or alcohol addiction, why not make today the day that you break the chains? At New Life Addiction Treatment Center in Port St. Lucie, Florida, we know it's not easy to pick up the phone and make that call. But remember, the caring staff at New Life is here to help. Count on us to partner with you to guide you towards getting your life back. Our confidential residential program takes most insurance plans and is designed to help meet your unique needs. Write this number down and give New Life Addiction Treatment Center a call right now. The toll-free number is 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. Your life is waiting for you, and so are we. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or getsobernow.net.
Welcome back to Break the Chains. Here again, your host, Gwen Cardin.
Before we resume, I'd like to remind you that I appreciate receiving feedback and ideas from listeners, and I would especially like to hear from you. So please take a couple of minutes after the show to email me your ideas and your comments at addictionradioshow@gmail.com. We're talking today to Sandy Swenson, author of The Joey Song. Sandy, in your book, you detail numerous times where you decided that you had to just walk away from this. And like many things, it is a process for many people as opposed to just being, I'm just going to do it and that's the end of it. Tell listeners a little bit about some of the events that happened in which you started to realize you had to walk away from Joey and start pursuing your own life, and kind of how that all evolved.
Oh, my goodness. There were so many, and it was such a process. It took years. It took years of the process of letting go to actually be letting go. I wouldn't say that I've ever walked away from him. I like to think of it as letting go, which is letting go of the enabling, which is letting go of the things that I was doing to help him, which were in fact hurting him. I also like to think that in my book, I clarify, because I think it is misunderstood, people look at letting go as walking away or turning one's back on their child, and I believe that I've done absolutely the opposite of that with Joey, that I have instead put down a foundation of very, very solid love for my son to stand on, not the addict. And I think the whole curve in learning about enabling is to be able to make that distinction, that when we're looking in the face of our child, who are we looking at? Is it the child or is it the addict? And which one is it that we're helping? Is it the child or the addict? And it took many, many years and many, many incidences of him being in jail and overdosed and horrible behavior and horrible words came out of his mouth. And with each one, I would say that I was done enabling him. And one time we were in court, and after we had been there, his dad and I, to support him, did one of his many arrests. And afterwards, we went down where he was being booked or something, and he told us that we had interfered because we were trying to help him and that we were nothing to him but sperm donors. Mm. And that was the first time that I absolutely positively told myself that I am done helping the addict. But probably within 2 days, I was helping the addict again, just in different ways. It took me a long time to understand that I cannot help the addict just some of the time, only in some ways, only when somebody's not looking. I had to absolutely stop helping the addict in all ways, at all times. That was a process that took years, just years. But the last time that happened was in 2008, after the third rehab, after a car accident where he was almost dead, after a month in prison, after so many overdoses and so many things had happened. And when he was kicked out of the last rehab, I was finally in the for the third time I'd been in a family program. And this was the time that I actually really understood what it was they had been saying all along, is that I'm actually helping to kill my child by the things that I'm doing to help him. And when I understood that, truly understood it, and that I was going to not care if my child hated me, because actually it would be the addict, what I really cared about was that my child knew I loved him enough to do the things that I needed to do, even if it didn't look like what we think love should look like in a normal mother-child relationship. Then And they told me that recovery can happen even if it does not happen with a child. It can happen within the family. Now, that's not what we had thought was going to happen every time he had gone to addiction treatment. We had always thought that he would get better. We never thought we were the ones that would have to learn how to recover from his addiction. But sadly, addiction is a horrible disease. And just because we go through the motions, the treatment, addiction is a horrible disease. And it devastates families, and not all of those stories are going to have a happy ending, or even an ending at all, as is in the case with us. It's just an ongoing story with no closure. And if we can't find a way to survive that, then not only are we shredding the family, but we really aren't providing a good, strong foundation for our beloved addict to find his recovery either.
Well, it's interesting. So you had to reframe. I had not heard that, but that makes total sense. You had to reframe how you were seeing your family being, as opposed to you just reached the point where you knew you couldn't help him anymore. So by reframing and saying, but I can help us and we can help ourselves, then that must have relieved some of the pressure, if not the heartbreak, but certainly the pressure.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it absolutely. The addiction was destroying one person. We had done all we could to help that person. We realized that you can't fix another person, but we can take responsibility for our end, and we will not let the addiction destroy our family any further. And we will tell him that we love him, and we will keep his place warm, and he knows that we love him. But we cannot do this for him. So when they say letting go with love, this is what they mean.
And you were actually able to let go with love and not basically relapse into the enabling behaviors?
Not anymore. I can say that in all honesty. Not anymore. Now I can say that it took a long time. But not anymore. I would say that for 2 years, at least, that I have not enabled my son at all. We have very careful interactions. I go to see him once a year. He's down in Florida. I go down there to find him and hopefully see him. It doesn't always work out. But when it does, we keep it at a time that works for him. We keep it where it's not too long, where things can turn south. So it has to be careful. If we were together too long, it would allow the opportunity possibly for manipulations and enablings to all start to rear their head. But no, the important thing that he knows is I will not enable him, the addict, because I love my son. And I tell him that. And there was a time when that made him angry. And now I think we've just come to a place where we both value the opportunity to get together and make a new memory, because neither of us know when we might have the opportunity to make another one. And I think that Joey shows up at most of those meetings. Not usually the addict.
And do you think that Joey showing up and not the addict has to do in large part with the fact that you did let go, that there's no longer this battle of wills going on between you?
I absolutely believe that. I believe that once it was perfectly clear to him, as long as there's a crumb, a little corner, a little something that he can work away at in order to manipulate, he will. Any addict will. But when it was absolutely clear that there was no manipulation to be had here, he tried for a while, he was mad for a while, and then it stopped. It just stopped. That was no longer a part of our relationship at all. So, yes, I do believe that once he knew the manipulation enabling door was slammed shut tight, but the love door was still wide open, it really changed everything.
But it has not impacted his sobriety. Apparently, he's still an active addiction. Is that correct?
I believe he is. I don't ask him about his addiction when I see him. I read the signs from his life because what I see shouts much more loudly than what I hear. So I take it all with everything he might say, I take with a grain of salt, and I just observe his life. My behaviors, which are the not enabling, would not necessarily make him become sober, but it's not going to make it any easier for him to remain an addict. So again, mm-hmm. his behaviors are completely in his control, but we do have a way, even though he's an addict, to connect, and he knows that he's loved, and he knows that he has quite a crew here with their arms wide open, hoping for him to make his way back.
Well, now, once you made this major shift, how did it change the quality of your life and that of your family members?
Oh, well, it changed a lot of things because for years, seriously, I was consumed with fixing Joey, and it freed my mind, heart, and soul to be able to give back now to the rest of my family. So that was huge. I know I just didn't have enough room in my brain to focus on anything else, and now I did. That was probably the biggest part of that.
I believe you got more involved in your community, and there were also things that you've been able to support your other son in that you might not have had time for before.
Absolutely, absolutely. And my younger son by then had gone off to college, so we had some catching up to do, and I did start to do work in the community because I wasn't able to do anything any longer to help my son other than love him. I still had a maternal need to do something with all the love I had for him. I started to work with youth in a group home, teaching them how to cook. My belief is that if I'm out there working with these young men, whose mothers at this time are, for whatever reason, unable to do something for them, somebody somewhere will be likely someday to do something for my son in a way that I can't do for him. So that helped me very much in order to have somewhere to put the care and love I had for my son.
Well, it's that time again when we have to take a quick break from the show, but stay tuned and we'll be right back.
If you're an adult suffering from drug or alcohol addiction, why not make today the day that you break the chains? At New Life Addiction Treatment Center in Port St. Lucie, Florida, we know it's not easy to pick up the phone and make that call. But remember, the caring staff at New Life is here to help. Count on us to partner with you to guide you towards getting your life back. Our confidential residential program takes most insurance plans and is designed to help meet your unique needs. Write this number down and give New Life Addiction Treatment Center a call right now. The toll-free number is 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. Your life is waiting for you, and so are we. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or getsobernow.net.
Is there someone you love who is suffering from alcohol or drug addiction? Do you feel like you simply don't know where to turn? We at Addiction Recovery Helpline know how painful it can be for both your loved one and for you and your family. We also realize that it's never easy to send someone you care about into rehab, but it's easier when you partner with us. Let Addiction Recovery Helpline assist your adult loved one to break the chains of addiction by finding just the right treatment center to meet their needs. Call us today toll-free at 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. It's too important to wait even one more day to make that call. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or on the web at getsobernow.net. Most insurance plans accepted.
You're listening to Break the Chains, America's top radio source of information for people struggling with drug or alcohol addiction. Here's your host, Gwen Cardin.
Before we resume talking to author Sandy Swenson, I want to invite you to go to our Facebook page and like us. You can find it at www.facebook.com/breakthechains1. Sandy, I know that parents of addicted children, or really just not parents, but even family members of addicts, are very often subjected to manipulations, things which appeal to the kinder, more compassionate sides of those who really don't understand the addiction, the whole addiction scenario. What are some things that you would advise people to be aware of that are almost always signs that you're being manipulated by an addict?
Well, there is a saying that addicts are master manipulators for a reason, and they really are. It seems that there is no boundary to the manipulations, and the addict, of course, is trying to do everything it can to get what it wants, and it will plow over anybody in its way. So money, of course, is huge. I can't tell you how many times I fell for loaning Joey money, and there was always a very good reason. And if I hadn't done it, I would have just felt horrible because he would have been with, you know, wouldn't have had a roof over his head or food in his mouth or something like that. It wasn't until much later, of course, that I realized that most of that was not true, that he would just do whatever it took, pull all the heartstrings in order to get what it was that the addict needed. So money, food. We did come to a point where Joey was asking for money because he was hungry. And I remember his dad telling him, Joey, you will never be hungry. If you're hungry, you come to our house. If you're hungry, call. We'll go out to eat. But we will never again give you money. So then Joey was just mad because, of course, wasn't about being hungry. It was about trying to sway us into giving him money so he could go buy his drugs or whatever.
So if they say, I need rent money, you pay the rent. You don't give them the money so they can go use it on drugs. I would think that was one thing you learned.
Well, actually, I wouldn't even give him the money. I wouldn't even pay the rent either, actually. I would have done that at the beginning. I would have done that in early on years. I would have thought, that's not enabling. I won't give him the money for the rent directly. I would just pay the rent myself. But then now I realize even that is enabling, because if he can't pay his rent, he needs to suffer those consequences as well. So no, I wouldn't even pay his rent.
But parents are going to say, but I can't bear to think that my child is going hungry or might be sleeping on the streets. I have to do this. What's wrong with that?
My child has slept on the streets. My child has absolutely been homeless. Could I have brought him home? Could I have put him in our bedroom, locked the door, slipped food under the door, kept him safe, a roof over his head, food for him? Is he learning how to cope with life? Who's keeping him sober, me or him? If he gets out, if he escapes, has he learned anything? No. I do believe it is a horrible, impossible, situation for a family to be in, to have to make these decisions. But I also believe that an addict will not hit bottom laying on a bed of roses. I believe that an addict will hit bottom skating around on thin ice.
So the sooner you can allow this person to skate on thin ice, the better? Is that part of the way that your thinking has now changed?
I would say that's true. I would say that if we make it easy for the addict to remain an addict, the more time the addict has to consume the child. So yes, the sooner it is that we are not helping them to have the things that make life comfortable and easy for the addict, the sooner the child may decide this is the time to try to get help.
So this is a way to mentally prepare for turning their back on the addict. And I like the way you make the distinction between the child and the addict, and you call addict the it. And that's a very powerful and good way to look at this. By turning your back on it, on the addict, is it easier to do that if you can view it in a less personal way?
Well, I truly believe it is the addict. The addict has consumed the body of the child. There's no longer the child that we knew. Anybody who loves an addict knows that the person behind that face isn't the child speaking anymore. And if we can remember that the child is in there and that that's the one that we want to honor and that's the one that we want to support and that's the one that we want to live to survive another day, not the addict, it does make it much easier for me to not enable. Again, though, I'd like to clarify that I don't look at that as turning my back. I don't believe that letting go is not the same as turning one's back on an addict. It is simply stopping the behaviors. It's letting go of the behaviors that enable the addict to continue to consume the mind, body, and soul of the child. That is not turning one's back on the child. Joey knows with every ounce of his being that we love him and we would never turn our back on him, that what we are doing is supporting him and not the addict.
Mm-hmm. And do you think this is the best way that a parent can mentally prepare him or herself for letting go, is to simply, to actually see it as two entities?
Oh, I don't know if that's the best way. That's the way I've been able to cope with it. That's the best way that I can cope with it, is to know that within my child's body is he exists and the addict exists. And my behaviors can support one or the other. And that is how I have been able to let go. And that is how I can wake up every day and put one foot in front of the other.
Do you still have the hope and the dream that Joey will get clean and sober and come back into your lives as a whole person?
I believe that as long as he's alive, there's hope. And I believe there's any disease that can be treated, as addiction can be, I believe that it's within Joey's power to get well. So I always have hope. Hope hurts. I've learned very much the hard way that hope hurts, but I do always have hope as long as he's still alive.
Has he read your book, do you know?
Yes, actually he has. He read it one time several years ago. He read the first bit of the manuscript, and he was on the run from one side of Florida, from trouble to one side to more trouble on the other side, and he read it on his iPhone, or I don't know if it's an iPhone, but his phone on the bus, and was actually after that was when the manipulations in our relationships changed. I think that he told me, he said, boy, he had no idea everything that was going on behind him. And I think that he read about my absolute conviction in no longer enabling him, and possibly all the hurt and trauma that went on touched him, but the manipulation absolutely stopped after that. Our relationship is just a different thing since he read the manuscript.
Very, very interesting. I just have about one more minute, and is there anything that you would like to add for people listening to the show right now who are maybe going through the same battle that I haven't asked you about?
Well, I would say if you think there's a problem, there probably is. And to not be concerned if the addict hates you, because the addict's not the one that matters. And even if you're overreacting, it's always better to take the loving action of trying to address the addiction rather than being afraid of making a mistake or hoping that it will go away.
Sandy, before we close, I'd like you to tell listeners how and when they can get a copy of your book and also how they can reach you. I know you have a very popular blog as well as the book.
Yes, the book, The Joey Song, will be published by Central Recovery Press in September. And my blog is at sandyswenson.com.
Okay, well, very good. Well, thank you so very much for your time. It was a very, very fascinating and heartwarming and heartbreaking story all at the same time. For now, this is your host, Gwen Carden. Be safe, live smart, and most of all, take good care of yourself.